This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
All right. Let's get to it. Welcome to Extension 720 on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Glad to be back for another episode. Tonight, author Lydia Slaby joins me to talk about her new book, Wait, It Gets Worse. In the book, Slaby talks about her life before and after cancer. Before, she was living an ambitious, high-powered life, a self-professed control freak, went to Harvard, worked as a high-powered attorney, even aspired to a life in politics. But then, she lost control, thanks to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And she realized that she never was in control. So she chose a different lifestyle, a different path. And she's my guest in the 8 o'clock hour. We continue our neighborhood tour tonight. Last time we brought you a conversation in Inglewood. Tonight, Jefferson Park. As more and more neighborhoods are choosing more progressive politics, Jefferson Park is going the other way. What happens when change comes in the form of changing back? Architecture critic, photographer, and former city planner Lee Bay joins me to talk about the buzzword of the moment, development. Both mayoral candidates promise it, and the current mayor is fast-tracking it. What should you be thinking about when it comes to how your city might look and feel? And community activists sound off on the proposed Lincoln Yards development, a development that could be the largest in city history. Is it progress or is it displacement? All that plus the hungry hound Steve Dolinsky on his move to go from prominent food broadcaster to food hall curator. It's Extension 720. Let's get started. All right. Fun to put these shows together when they work. There's not such technical difficulty. Apologize for that.
I love the music.
Yeah, it's good, right? It's a good little track.
I love it.
Well, with the preemptions from Blackhawks and the White Sox, we got more time to put segments together. It's almost like a puzzle. And tonight, the theme seems to be centered around transformation. How something becomes something else. Moving from one place to another. Life and what happens after. And I was thinking about all this and the segments on the show when a small story popped up in my Twitter feed. It was an obit. In the Windy City Times. Barbara Hammer, a prominent lesbian filmmaker, died at the age of 79. She died over the weekend. She died of ovarian cancer. And I wasn't familiar with her work. A lot of experimental films in the 70s. But reading on, I saw that she had done a few lectures at the Whitney in New York City. They're very popular. She did one, and she did another one. But it was called The Art of Dying. The obit just mentioned this in passing. But I dug deeper. It turns out that Barbara was terminal. And there was no more treatment options left. She wanted to die. But nobody would let her. And nobody would talk about it. She put together this lecture to do just that. To break the stigma of talking about death. And she implored artists of all stripes to be brave, to be bold, and to be open and honest about the most transformative part of life, which is death.
There is a general fear of talking about death in the Western world. It is as if by not mentioning and discussing it, it would go away. We do ourselves a disservice to not engage in ruminations of this most powerful life force. For aren't we alive until our last breath? And isn't this a rite of passage we wish to address in our art, in our seminars, and in our museum exhibitions? By hesitating to face the last phase of life, we give a message to hush up and avoid. And platitudes then come out like, you'll get better, you're tough, you'll beat it. You know, you look good today. Instead of discussing terminal disease.
Yeah, Barbara goes on, she talks about her work, but she also talks about the transformative power of terminal illness. It's so emotional, it's personal, and at the same time, very informative.
I have lived a good long life. I just know that you know that. But now I have reached a period of living with increased diminished capabilities due to a cancer that can't be cured and for which I have had every treatment possible. I am in palliative care and preparing for the end. I feel fortunate that I have the awareness of this approaching death, allowing me to make plans, say goodbyes, and settle affairs. But I'm angry. not about my impending death, although there have been times when I have been angry about that, of course, but that the government has determined that I must linger through probable unconsciousness, pain, or in a deep drugged state, preventing me from being aware. I prefer a conscious death, a death I can be proud of, a dignified death, a death where I have a chance to clearly say goodbye to friends and family, a death where I'm able to save my spouse the agony of watching me suffer or lie in a coma for days. I tell you now that this is my life and should be my death.
You know, I never thought about dying this way. I never thought much about how we treat it. And to be honest, I'm still not sure why I clicked on a tweet to read about a woman I knew nothing about in life, but now seem to want to know all about in death. In a way, that was my transformative moment for the week. What's yours? Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. We got a big show about transformation tonight. 312-981-7200. I'm serious. What's your transformative moment from this week? Let us know. 312-981-7200. I think we're back on the rails when it comes to our technical difficulties. Thanks to everybody in the building that helped us out to get us back online. Coming up, architecture critic and former city planner Lee Bay will be in the building to talk about development of all stripes. What is a city going to look like under the new mayor? There seems to be mega development after mega development announced every time we blink an eye. I go downstairs to get coffee, come back up, boom, another skyscraper. There's another crane. But before we talk with Lee, let's talk about one of the biggest developments, Lincoln Yards. You've seen the billboards off the Kennedy. It's the space along the northern branch of the Chicago River, mostly where the Finkel Steel plant once stood. The plan by Sterling Bay and the city of Chicago is to create a vast new development that would include thousands of condos spread out between high rises, park space, music clubs, even at one time a soccer stadium has been floated. It's one of, if not the biggest developments in Chicago history. And it's also one of the most contentious. Why? Because a massive project is sandwiched between two communities, Lincoln Park and Bucktown. And residents there are worried about the size, the scope, the traffic implications, and the impact on local art. But why should I tell you that when my next guests are living it? Katie Tutton is the co-owner of The Hideout and also the co-chair of the group Civil. That's the Chicago Independent Venue League. The other co-chair is Robert Gomez, known to the music community just as Gomez, as he owns Subterranean and Beat Kitchen. And my third guest is Hu Wen, one of the leaders of the group Raise Your Hand Action. I took a trip to the Hideout to talk with the three community activists. The Hideout on Wabanzia is in the shadows of Lincoln Yards. How do you feel about Lincoln Yards?
That's a loaded question. Just start right off, Justin. It's unfortunate that they really didn't come and speak to us, the community, and certainly their neighbors. I mean, we are right smack dab in the middle of it. And they only came to speak with us once, and we're a public space. At any time, they could have walked through the door and asked to have a meeting with us. Often, Tim and I are here, my partners Mike and Jim, but instead waited kind of to the ninth hour to come speak with us. So my opinion of them is not very high at all. And witnessing what happened when we would go to city council meetings and committee meetings, it was a tell that their folks spoke first, our people had to wait, and we were, I felt, muzzled.
Gomez, let me bring you in, because they will say, and I've seen the city planners talk about this, the aldermen and other places, they say this is the most public, transparent situation in the history of Chicago, that they've made their efforts to reach out. Do you think, see it that way?
They've put on a good show. I'll give them that. They've had some public meetings, but I think it feels like all of this was predetermined. How many condos, the music district, which they originally called entertainment district, and now they're calling it character zone. It's semantics. It's a game. It feels like they're just playing a game.
And who I want to bring you in, because when you think about the Chicago River and the North Branch, it is a lot of leftover industrial. It seems like it would be in need of some sort of development. So why not Lincoln Yards?
The bigger question is, can it happen without the TIFs, right? And so for us with Raise Your Hand Action, our big issue is using public tax dollars to do so. Designating this as a district would really freeze all those tax dollars that would go back to Chicago public schools, go back to the parking, you know, the parks and all the other taxing bodies. So this is really fundamentally the issue of why use public tax dollars when we know that area is not a blighted area in that sense, right, in the surrounding, and that private development would happen.
Most developments, I believe there's one recently, I think it's to the west of Soldiers Field, where the developer said, we're going to develop this and not ask for any TIF money. So the thing is, they can do this without the TIF dollars. Absolutely. You know, this is all about greed, really. Why do we have to pay for it?
I saw that the piece in the New York Times talking about Hudson Yards, which is a piece in New York. Why is it, and I ask you guys as you pay attention to this stuff, that was substantial investment, taxpayer money, something like $6 billion of taxpayer money in New York City, but you don't have a lot of people out front with protesting or saying that this is a misuse of funds. Why so much fervor over this project in Chicago when there are projects like it that have even more money in other cities that seem to be okay with taxpayers?
Well, I think one of the big issues is that we're putting this in between Bucktown and Lakeview. It's not lakefront. It's not as the other Hudson Yards is right next to the water. You're talking about 60-story buildings, 15 buildings over 50 stories in between Lakeview, and Lincoln Park and Bucktown, Wicker Park and Andersonville. I mean, this is another, they talk about it being a city within a city. This is a giant suburb. This is like downtown Detroit. I mean, I've been jokingly calling it Schaumburg Yards, and it's gotten some traction, but what can it possibly look like? It won't be historic looking. They're calling it a bridge between neighborhoods, and it's a giant wall between neighborhoods.
What's to say that this isn't positive change for a city of Chicago that is looking to grow its tax base, is looking to develop on land that has been industrial or forgotten about along the Chicago River? What's wrong with that?
Well, it's being designed by a very small group of people. And my question is, if it can stand on its own merit, why can't it wait? You know, because there are so many unanswered questions. So my big thing is, what's the big secret? Why is it you can't tell us?
I would add that the project itself is tainted. I mean, since the beginning, when you think about who was the lawyer for Sterling Bay the last 10 years, it was Ed Burke. And that sort of ties in, you know, going back to your question earlier about why do you think in Chicago people are up in arms versus in New York City and the Hudson Bay? And I really would say that, you know, the residents have woken up. I mean, you can look in this election alone and see that we're ready for reform. We're ready for a different city council. Yep. And we're ready for clean and transparent governance in the city, which we've not had. And when you think about the schools and the closures in 2011, 2012, that already, right, really significantly, I think, played a role in the sort of political education that parents and the youth who are leading part of, you know, the more recent connections to this sort of tainted scandal, when you think about Ed Burke, is the sale of the land, part of the parcels of this Lincoln Yard, part of that money was used to then buy and purchase the land where the Cop Academy is going to be built. So you see that there are these just wheeling and dealings that are happening in City Hall that we know that are very corrupt, and the city and the residents are really just fed up with it.
Where are the numbers that justify the tax base? What if we're really dealing with displacement? Think of the condos, 6,000 condos. Where are those people going to come from? Cincinnati? They're going to come from other condo owners or people who already live in Chicago. And more importantly, what got our attention is you're talking about 10,000 people going to see concerts for shows. Where are those 10,000 going to come from? Detroit? I mean, they're going to come from Chicago. That means 10,000 people who aren't going into Wicker Park or to hide out or Rogers Park. We're actually fighting more on behalf of, of neighborhoods that are further away.
Right.
Avondale, there are two brand new venues in Avondale. Uptown, there's been significant investment there. People won't be going there. They'll be going to Lincoln Yards, and they'll be moving away from other neighborhoods into Lincoln Yards. What if it's just displacement? Where's the data to support that?
And we're a city of neighborhoods. That's what makes our neighborhood great, the city great. In our neighborhood, great.
There is a lot of politics involved, and I think it really well said about the idea of the difference between New York and Chicago is that you get the feel with Chicago that there's just a few people that are trying to make this happen as fast as possible.
Basically, we're saying that in the city of Chicago, we have very brilliant people. Collectively, we should all come together and come up with, this is one of the largest land deals, I think, since the Chicago fire. So bring us all together. Bring the urban planners. Bring people with big ideas. And we collectively can do it rather than a couple of developers whose main motivation is profit.
The whole show tonight is about transformation, and it's very specific and almost too easy to say, oh, well, we'll talk about Lincoln Yards and how that's going to transform this north branch of the river. But we're talking about so much more, especially when it comes to Chicago politics, when it comes to how we make these decisions, when we take the biggest, in, like you said, land purchase in recent history in Chicago. There's a lot that goes into what it means to transform.
Well, and I would add, too, that I think this, you know, this term of transformation is sort of a one of these buzzwords, right? And it's certainly in the political arena, and I feel like this is way more transactional, right? When you look at the pay-to-play, it's not about transforming a city and really spreading the redistributing the resources, right, which are what TIFs were designed for. It certainly is a project that's, like, really rooted in inequities, and we're going to see, and if we're really going to be honest about transforming, you're going to transform even deeper between those who have and have-nots, and so for us, you know, as community organizers, as business leaders, we are really wanting to transform, truly authentically transform the city where we are bridging communities and not building more silos.
That's Hu Wen, who she is one of the leaders of the group Raise Your Hand Action. You also heard from Katie Tutton, who's one of the co-owners of The Hideout and a co-chair of the group Civil, along with Robert Gomez, who also owns Subterranean and Bee Kitchen. We reached out to Sterling Bay, and they promised that they would grant an interview, but not at this time. When we come back, architecture critic and longtime WGN contributor Lee Bay will join us to talk about what we should be looking for in a city when it comes to a year from now, 5 years, 10 years, 50 years. We'll continue the conversation about development, the buzzword that's taken over the election on Extension 720. Stay with us. Can you say you're listening to Extension 720 on WGN Radio?
I'm listening to Extension 720 on WGN Radio.
Let's do it one more time. Can you say you're listening to Extension 720 on WGN Radio?
I am listening to...
So you say, like, you're talking to... We're still working it out. Beyond the technical difficulties, we also are working out our IDs and our tags. But it is the new Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Thanks, Andrea, for the news. Well, we continue our conversation. Right before the news, you heard from some people who are in opposition of the Lincoln Yards development on the near north side of Chicago along the Chicago River. Lee Bay, longtime architecture critic, I would say city planner when you were working in the mayor's daily administration. Also an author, the South Side Architecture book's coming up. I want to talk about that. I know that's not out yet, but talk about it. It's coming. Lee, always great to see you, man. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Great to see you, too.
So this, am I wrong to say that the word development is the buzzword of 2019? It feels like I'm hearing develop, whether it's economic, whether it's downtown. The word development is taking on a definition of its own.
It really is. And, you know, it's the difference in some aldermanic races that we saw, whether a ward has too little development and the neighbors are in uproar about that justifiably, or in the neighborhoods where there's a sense there's too much. But throughout the city, this is the topic.
It's amazing to me. Let's start with Lincoln Yards on the near north side of Chicago. This is a second ward. And obviously, Brian Hopkins, the alderman there, he ran unopposed. It's all set there. Mm-hmm. But there's two aldermen on either side that are... When you see these mega developments, especially something like Lincoln Yards, where they're talking about these massive buildings at 50 stories, and you know exactly where that's going along the north branch of the Chicago, what's your first reaction to that?
You know, it's really tough. My first reaction is, you know, great, there's some development in the city. You know, the city's been losing population since since the 50s, really, since the 60s and 70s especially, and now it's beginning to grow back. But it's growing back in certain spots and not others, that which leads to the other part of how I feel. So I really wear kind of two hats, double-minded in a sense, about how I feel about this.
Yeah, and as an architecture critic, when you see the proposals for the kind of outsized buildings, and I don't want to just back, because there's other developments we'll get into, but there has been sort of a startling, when you look at Lincoln Yards, you're talking about high rises that would be 50 stories, you know, and you think about the area in the north side of Chicago, there's nothing like it. There's
exactly.
Maybe there's an 8-story building or a 10-story building, but there's nothing remotely close. When, as a planner, as an architecture critic, when something like that comes up in a space that doesn't have that to begin with, what's your thought on that? Does that help? Does it hinder the look of a neighborhood?
You know, the where the rubber meets the road really literally is at the ground level. How does the building respond to the pedestrians who walk by? Where's the transit connections? Can you get in and out of it effectively? So a tall buildings in and of themselves are not bad things, but where it meets the ground, does it meet the ground at a human scale, do the buildings overwhelm you? That's one thing architecturally. But really, how the building functions when you get to street level really is where these buildings are made and broken, and these complexes are, especially when green space is added, pitched as open space and park space. But this is but this is often not the case.
Right.
There are parks planned for this one. But essentially, private developers are building these private green spaces, and how much of this space is really public you know, it makes a big difference.
That's a really good point. That when you hear green space or park space, and you see it in these developments, there'll be this kind of park space, all sorts of green space. That's private green space. They will have the right. They will have private security to say, Lee, you can't hang out here.
That's right. Especially me. I mean, I tend to hang out for a while. I mean, but there are parks playing here. But again, it all looks seamless in rendering. So where the line comes is drawn between what's mine and what's theirs, is crucial.
As someone who has been, a part of, has a history in city planning, when are we in a new phase when it comes to city planning? When you have Lincoln Yards or the 78 or the planned skyscrapers along Soldier Field, that developers are have a larger seat at the table or more power than they might have had in the past?
You know, they've always had their they've always had the big chair at the table. It does seem as if that the chair has gotten a little bigger, and these large developments, and again we're seeing a series of them proposed and planned. You know, it really, I can see why the neighbors around the 78 wanted to put the brakes on this and really want to ask some questions about what these things can really do and the impact of them, because whatever is done here that's successful will be repeated throughout the rest of the ones that we see.
And the 78 is the south side of the branch of the river along Chinatown and that area.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the same kind of issues that play out on the north branch. It really is just about public transparency. The city has said, and they continue to say, this has been the most publicly transparent project we've ever done. We had community meeting after community meeting. We're letting people know what we're going to do. There's space for community to get up and talk. Do you buy that?
You know, yes and no. I mean, there's room to talk, but how much change can the residents really push for? And at some point, these things always follow a similar pattern where it seems like the horse is out of the barn and it's like, it's time to build, right? And there are public meetings. I'm talking generally, not necessarily about this project in particular.
Yeah, sure.
But there's often public meetings. But again, can you stop it? Can you really change it? Is the question.
Okay. Skyscrapers out the wazoo in this town right now. There are cranes all around the building we're in right now. I read on Curb that there were 42 projects of skyscrapers that were under construction or announced. Do you worry about the density? Do you worry about the architectural look of downtown Chicago, the skyline, if you will?
You know, the density I don't worry about. I mean, the city was built for 3 million, had 3 million people in it, was planned for 8 million, again, throughout the city, not concentrated in one spot. So I think there's a lot of room here for us to grow. Again, it gets back to how these things knit themselves into the rest of the city fabric. Are they islands, right? Or are they, really integral parts of the neighborhood where people can flow from the neighborhood into the complex and out. Architecturally, though, I do have some concern that there's a certain blandness that's come into many of these developments. There's a sameness. If you were to lay down on the sidewalk and look up in front of some of these buildings, you couldn't tell whether You know, there's some distinctive ones like Vista Tower
that's right next door to us.
You know, that really use shape and form to give you something different. But often it's like a glass box, anonymous glass, blue glass box. It's almost as bad as it was when I first started writing about architecture back in the 90s, where it seems like when the River North got developed, and it seems like every building was this sort of margarine colored stick with parking at the bottom. And just deadly yellowish concrete at going all the way up. And you're like, how many times can they build this? And we found out.
Lee Bay is in studio with me here on Extension 720. We'll take a quick break and come back. I want to talk about the other part of development, what's not being developed. Mm-hmm. And you talked about there are dense areas that seem to be concentrated development, but there's a lot of Chicago that's not being, and we'll talk about that. Lee Bay in studio. Stay with us. Back at it here on Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. Lee Bay in studio. We're talking about the future look and feel of the city of Chicago. And obviously, we have touched on downtown and the various projects that are happening here and some of the announced mega developments in, the collar neighborhoods, the downtown collar neighborhoods. Let's talk about some of the other areas of the city. Both mayoral candidates have promised development in whatever form, with that economic development, public safety development, but also business development. Is there a way that we will see in this decade or in the next term of mayor more development in some of the other neighborhoods in Chicago?
You know, I certainly hope so. And I think that the success of whoever sits in that seat, that big seat on five, the success of their term, of her term, depends on what happens in these neighborhoods, particularly the South and West Side, where you've seen so much disinvestment followed by so much population loss. What's happening is that clearly in the collar communities around downtown, as you so well put it, it's almost a bright new city.
Right.
That I think that the population of it, when I was hitting the Central Area Committee about 10 years ago, 7 or 8, 10 years ago, we felt that it could be a population of 250,000 between Cermak and Fullerton and the Lake and,
right.
and maybe Ashland. And you can see that coming to pass. That's the second largest city in Illinois by far. So what happens outside of that border becomes key. And, you look at places like Southworks, abandoned steel plant on the south side, 500 acres on the lake. What's happening there?
Mm-hmm.
And where's the push to make something happen there?
And that's a great place to talk about. Mm-hmm. Because there have been, over time, a couple of little plans floated by different mayors. There was the big city, the big development down there that was going to be condos, mm-hmm. and everything, and that kind of fell through. But now you hear the casino. You hear that's where a casino could go. Is that the kind of development that mayoral candidates are going to step up, or mayors are going to step up and go, we did it, we brought a casino to your neighborhood?
Boy, I hope not. I'm a Southsider, as you know, born and raised, and I live in Pullman, and I cringe, frankly, when I hear about casinos coming to Lake Calumet and that kind of thing, because to me, and I'm going to get in trouble with some friends of mine, so I'm already expecting the phone calls, to me, that's lazy development. What happens is that you need a plan. The South Side, and you and I have talked about this before, physically is the size of Philadelphia, right? So we're solving this problem with these little dinks and dunks, like that offensive coordinator for the Bears used to do, you know, 3-yard passes
when
there's a guy in the end zone with his hands wide open.
Right.
And what needs to happen here is city-scale planning, right? It's the population of Detroit in a city the size of Philadelphia. I mean, we're talking about a major piece of real estate. It has railroads running through it, public transit, all kinds of things, factory places for industrial. This is a city that needs to be planned. And the next mayor is going to have to see it that way, or the slide is going to continue.
But it can't be altruistic, right? It can't be something where a politician comes in and says, all right, this is for the good of the South Side. This is good. Their developers want to make money.
That's right.
And can they make money in a neighborhood like Inglewood? Can they make money in Pullman?
You know, they can. I mean, you see what's happening in Inglewood at the 63rd and Halsted retail node, which was as dead as a retail node could get. And there's signs of life coming back there, the Whole Foods and other things. But the same thing that brings development to Lincoln Yards, which is a developer willing to do it, and a whole bunch of public money to help him do it, that's the same thing that has to happen on the South and West Sides. We can't all of a sudden say, you only get a few thousand dollars,
right,
or a couple of million dollars. No, you have to put money in it. The Brookings Institute had a study about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, that talked about the wealth that was robbed nationwide from black neighborhoods by devaluing the houses that are there, that a house equal, you know, in a neighborhood that's equal to a white neighborhood is worth half as much, I think, or 23%.
It's Natalie Moore's less. Book.
Exactly.
That, yeah.
And so what's happened to these neighborhoods over the past 50 years really is a form of theft, right? How do you make, when you steal from someone, how do you make them whole? You give them back what you took. And that's the kind of investment that has to happen
there. Let's ask, we'll end on one of the big developments that's happening on the South Side, which is the Obama Presidential Center. Mm-hmm. We're not sure if it's going to happen because of lawsuits, but is that the kind of development that could spurn other development?
Not in and of itself. I'm going to get in trouble for this too. The library itself.
Love when you come on, Lee.
I know, right? I'm always. The library itself isn't a magic pill. You build a library, and all of a sudden, stuff will start popping up around it. There has to be serious urban planning that says, if this investment is going here, what can we do to put stuff around it? Just to show you what can happen, 63rd and Stony Island is just about, you know, dead. Was an exciting node. Now it isn't. The idea that the library could help bring it back. 63rd and Cottage Grove, on the other hand, which was equally as dead, is now coming back to life again. There's transit there. Is there a discussion to put the L back so that it runs toward the library? Right. These are the kind of things that have to happen. But the library in and of itself, it's not like Bilbao in 96. Frank Gehry designs this great building in the downtrodden city in Spain, and this beautiful thing happens. The city flourishes. That's not what's going to happen here without the absence of a plan to make sure that investment is multiplied.
Love it when you're here, man. Lee Bay, longtime architecture critic and reporter. He was also a city planner with the city, and he's an author. He's got his Southside Architecture book coming out in October.
October.
What's the title?
Southern Exposure, The Overlooked Architecture of Chicago's South Side, October 15th. Yeah,
I love it.
Thank you, sir.
And also, the best blog on architecture that ever was out there was called Beyond the Boat Tour. He used to get in trouble for that, too, from the people downtown. But Beyond the Boat Tour was tremendous.
That was fun.
Lee, great to see you, and I hope that you'll be a regular on this program.
Thank you. Love to.
All right, we'll come back. Lydia Slaby's going to join me. We're going to talk about her new book, Wait, It Gets Worse. It's Extension 720. Stay with us. Thanks, Andrea. It's Extension 720, the new Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. 312-981-7200. We continue to explore transformation. That's the theme of tonight's program. We heard about it with Lincoln Yards and a little bit with Lee Bay, and also what we talked about at the beginning of the show as well. And we continue. 312-981-7200. If you want to talk transformation, give us a ring, and you also can text us on the line. My guest tonight is the author of Wait, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. It's a memoir written by one-time Chicagoan Lydia Slaby. Slaby tells her story of the life before and after cancer. She was diagnosed at 33 years of age. It's a story that many cancer survivors can relate to. Once you're diagnosed and you suffer through various stages of treatment, you have to make a choice. When do you go back? Back to life as you knew it, back to your job, back to your purpose. But in this book, the real question is not when you go back, but when do you go forward? Lydia Slaby is a writer, motivational speaker. She serves on a few not-for-profit boards, including right here in Chicago. She's an advisor to the great organization, Second Story. Lydia Slaby, my guest on Extension 720. Lydia, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So this book, and let's get right into it, you kind of set it up that you're living the happy life.
Yep.
You know, you are high-powered and high-octane, getting degrees and working as a lawyer and working in political offices. Let's pick it up there, that you had a 24/7 life.
I really did. I mean, up until I was 33, I very much had an enviable life. I mean, it's hard. I'm not going to deny that. I had graduated from a very good university. I'd spent a good deal of my 20s working for the Massachusetts state government at a high level under Governor Deval Patrick. And then I came here and I went to Northwestern for my JD MBA, and I did 5 years of schooling in three. And then I launched out of that into one of the big law firms in Chicago's Loop. And I was busy. I was very busy. I was very successful inside that busyness, but I was very busy. And meantime, I also got married and, you know, life.
And how much of that was just ambition, where you were like, I need to get to a certain spot. This is where I need to be.
I was never told that not having that ambition wasn't an option. And it's not that my parents were constantly tiger-momming me. It's that, you know, I had this brain and I had this education and I had this position and I was always told and I always felt that I had to do something worthwhile with that. And working really hard and striving was my way of doing that. I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do with any of it, but I knew that if I just worked really, really, really hard, then somehow I would eventually trip across the answer.
The book starts on the days before you are diagnosed, and it really is the day that you go to the doctor.
Yep.
And you talk about, you know, just the crazy hectic schedule. You're going to a wedding in New York City, and you were coming, you're coming in, you're coming out. You had a lot of things on your plate. When you think back to that moment, what comes up? What talk us about right before you go to the doctor?
Oh, that morning I'd been up until 1 or 2 in the morning the night before working on a document for work. I, you know, woke up and took a shower, and we were trying to figure out the wedding that weekend. I was diagnosed on a Thursday, and so we were leaving that Friday. And it was one of those questions of, am I actually going to be able to go to the wedding, or am I going to have to keep working through the weekend? And
it wasn't that there's something wrong with my health. It was about work.
Not at all. Right. Everything I was focused on was related to work. And in the meantime, I couldn't really breathe. My chest hurt. I was super swollen. My upper body was very swollen. And I had in the back of my mind, oh, yeah, I got to go to the doctor at 11 because of this thing that I'm dealing with, whatever that thing is. But it was very much an afterthought, complete afterthought.
When you went to the doctor that day, and the doctor started to recognize that there was something more than just maybe a respiratory problem or allergies or whatever it might be, they started to send you different places. At what point did you realize that this was more serious than you were taking it?
So my GP quote unquote heard something wrong with my heart. And I was like, okay, great. I'll just go to the cardiologist sometime next week. And she sat me down. She was like, no, you're going to sit in my waiting room until I get you in to see him this afternoon.
Which for you at that point, you were kind of not angry, but you were frustrated by that.
Yeah. And I was like, what? Like, I've got better things to do with my time than to wait around for a cardiologist. You know, I mean, this is my heart we're talking about. Right. And so that was when I began to sort of sneaky get that suspicion that maybe something was wrong. I also texted my husband saying, you know, oh, my GP's holding me hostage and she won't let me leave. And he walked out. He was working for the Obama reelection campaign at the time. And he walked out of a meeting and came to join me to have lunch with me while we were waiting up at Northwestern's medical campus. And actually, it was the fact that he walked out of a meeting and joined me for lunch while we were waiting that I was like, oh, wait, maybe there really is something wrong with me.
Yeah, why would he do that?
Why would he do that? You know, he's busy. I'm busy. And then the cardiologist saw that my heart was under extreme stress and surrounded by fluid. And then he dumped me into the ER. And, you know, the day sort of kept progressively getting medically worse. So really, by the time I was in the ER, I knew that there was something going on. But even then, I mean, the cardiologist was like, I don't know, you probably had a really bad cold, and now it's just the byproduct of that, and we have to deal with your heart, but you are fine.
Right.
And even then, that was tough.
It was a CT scan, of course, that came back and showed, and you have a very well-written passage about looking at that.
Thank you.
Where you get to the point where there's the black blob, you know, or whatever. I forget if that's the right way you determine it. But that moment of everybody recognizing that the shadow was not a shadow and that it was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Right. So it was this actually amazing moment where the doctor flipped through the pictures on the screen of what my CAT scan had shown. And, you know, organs and bones and blood vessels are all various shades of gray. And as she was scrolling up through my chest, we saw my lungs and then we saw my heart and all various shades of gray. And then suddenly there was this black blob. And it was about the size of a grapefruit. And it was sitting on top of my heart and in between my lungs. And it was one of those things where it was like, oh, that's not supposed to be there. And I remember looking at the screen and going, well, that's not supposed to be there, so how could that possibly be there? So that's not actually there. Like, immediately my brain was just like, nope, that's not possible. This is like some sort of magic animation.
The control freak in you.
Yeah. I was like, this is not a thing. We're just going to pretend that this is not a thing.
And I know what's right. This is wrong. I know what's right.
And it was as she sort of was scrolling up and down, and I could really see the picture of it, that was when I began to go, oh no. And she'd already said the word lymphoma, and she was just showing it to me, showing the extent of how bad it was.
And it took a while to get to what it was, but
yeah,
you had cancer in your family. Your sister was she was in treatment.
Yep. So my sister.
So yeah. there is this weight on your family already. You know what that means. You know what that diagnosis means.
I do. I did, and that was partially. I mean, I can only guess, but that was the reason why I was ignoring the diagnosis. My sister had cancer for 6 years previously. Unfortunately, she's still in it. So now she's dealing with it now for 13 years. But and so I knew in my family that CAT scans that showed that looked like that could only mean really horrible things. And I'd witnessed it with my sister, you know, infusion suites and stem cell transplants and going bald and losing fertility and all of the things that cancer treatment does to the body. I was determined that was not going to be my life.
Lydia Slaby's my guest. Her new book is Wait, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. The story that really chronicles her life before and after cancer. We'll continue the conversation. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Lydia Slaby in studio. So stay with us.
This is Extension 720 on WGN Radio. Here's Justin Kaufman.
Continuing our conversation with Lydia Slaby, her book is Wait, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. Did you know you were a control freak before this book came out? Before you tell your story and before cancer, were you a self-described control freak?
Oh, sure, right? I mean, you can't achieve that much that quickly, that young, without having some imaginary superpower that you can control the cosmos to behave as if you want it to behave.
A lot of times control freak will be a derogatory term. People will say, oh, you're such a control freak. Do you embrace it?
No, I recognize that it was probably not one of my more pleasant attributes, let's put it that way. But I also recognize that it was part of why I was so successful in life. And so it was a little bit of a double-edged sword. And so I very much tried to be a good friend and not control my friends more or less successfully, maybe not. but I was fully aware that this was an aspect of my personality that had brought me both achievement as well as shame.
The reason I bring it up is that the next chapter of our conversation has to do with treatment. Because after you were diagnosed, it comes down to chemotherapy, and it comes down to how they're going to rid your body, or at least limit the cancer that's in your body. It must have been hard being a control freak at that moment. I mean, because a lot of this book is about losing control.
Yes, it was exceptionally hard in that moment because the whole thing was such an emergency. I was admitted to the hospital as an acute cardiac patient, and then, you know, very quickly they figured out what kind of cancer I had, and so they knew what kind of treatment they wanted me to do. They wouldn't let me. I mean, people have choice in this matter, but the hospital really didn't want me to leave the hospital until I had gone through chemotherapy. And it was all so fast. You know, I mean, like, I hadn't thought about other treatments. I hadn't thought about going to meditate in Mexico on a beach somewhere. I mean, I don't know. You know, but there were no options in front of me, and we spoke about my sister, and I called her sort of in the middle of this maelstrom, and I said, "What do I do?" I mean, that was probably exactly what I said, and I'll read you a little bit from the book, so. Enter my sister with her years of hard-won experience fighting her own cancer. I know it doesn't seem like you even have a choice, but you do, she said over the phone, understanding my attempt at explaining these unfamiliar feelings. Either you can decide to surrender to their protocol and collaborate with them to make it work for you, or you can decide to be angry that you didn't have a choice and everything that's about to happen to you is someone else's fault. Then she told me she loved me very much. You are my one and only sister. Please, for your sake, decide to own your treatment. Otherwise, you will spend the rest of your life, for however long you have, furious and miserable about those doctors who ruined my life. And so that was the first conversation that I had, the first thought process of, okay, I can't control what's going on around me, but what I can start to do is control how I react to it.
Yeah.
I can choose to make choices that I didn't realize I had. I can choose to be kind in the face of those choices. And that was the very beginning inkling of the whole process of, instead of controlling everything outside of me, learning how to control things inside of me.
It's in the book, that's what you talk about, and that, thank you for reading that. And it did you accept that? Did you accept the words of your sister who had gone through that? Like, because, you know, obviously for the purposes of the book, it moves along, you accepted it. But personally, at that time, were you like, nah, or did you have that meditative moment to say, she's right?
On that particular point, I was totally delighted to have her be right, because I didn't have a choice.
Right.
And so the fact that I could create a choice out of what I thought wasn't a choice was wonderful. Everything else, though, I kind of ignored her advice. Because, I mean, you know, life's a process, right?
Right.
Like, we're all growing and changing.
Right.
And so I got very practiced at it in accepting the decisions around my treatment and accepting the decisions around sort of the medicine of what was going on. I grew to love my time in the hospital. My husband and I really created it to be a fun moment for us and our friends. But the rest of it was not as easy.
You know, you say later in the book that one of the dirty secrets you say to the reader, you know, I wanted to be back in the hospital. The hospital was a refuge. The hospital, because it sounds like they took care of, you know, you collaborated with the choices you were making, but you get to lose control. They took control and you were able to be more patient?
Yes. And actually, that little part of the book, it happens after I'm done with treatment and I'm actually back at work. And you're very right, it was a dirty secret. I was very guilt-stricken about this secret. And I'll read you a little bit. So here's my dirty secret. From the first minute that I went back to work, all I wanted was to go back to the hospital. Despite the fact that being sick is horrible and undergoing chemo is even worse, the hospital itself felt secure to me. In all my adult life, it was the only place I had ever felt truly comfortable. I knew exactly why I was there and what I was supposed to do while there. I was a control freak with nothing to control, so I could finally rest.
Hmm.
And it was this, the hospital just provided that to me. I mean, it's like, you know why you're going. I'm going to the hospital today to save my life. And this is what I am doing in order to save my life.
And everything else can be put on pause, and you can put it to the side.
Nothing
else
matters.
This is what we're doing today.
Exactly.
Which is a far cry from what you were doing before you were diagnosed. It felt like at the beginning of this book, you had 19 things going on in 18 seconds.
Yes, exactly. And it was all over the place, and I didn't really understand where my role was inside any of it.
We'll continue our conversation. Lydia Slaby is here. Her new memoir, Wait, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. It chronicles her struggles with treatment, but also life before and after cancer. And when we come back after Andrea's newscast, let's talk about after, because, you know, I don't want to think you can get the whole feel from the book, and we feel like we're skipping a big chunk of treatment and the things you went through, but we'll continue the conversation. Lydia Slaby is here on Extension 720, so stay with us. Thanks, Andrea. It's Extension 720. Here on 720 WGN, I'm Justin Kaufman. We're continuing the conversation with Lydia Slaby. She's the author of Wait, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. We're talking about her experience before and after cancer and the treatment, the story of treatment. And cancer treatment, for anyone who's gone through it or has had loved ones go through it, it is a traumatic experience. Your experience was traumatic, and then you add on top of it surgery, a heart surgery that was unexpected. There's a lot of trauma in your treatment.
Yes, there was. There was trauma at diagnosis, and then there was trauma in the multiple. And chemo, just in and of itself, is traumatic. And then I had a chest cracking surgery, shall we say, to remove the tumor 2 months after I finished chemo, and then 18 months after that, I had an emergency heart situation. And Yeah, all of it. Trauma. Good stuff for ER.
There is, you know, obviously this memoir, the ability to tell this story, it has to be somewhat therapeutic to do so, but you have to relive it. You'll do interview after interview and you'll talk about it. And I always think about, you know, when reading these personal details of being in the moment and writing about being in the moment, is it hard for you to go back to that space?
Not anymore. It was really hard to write it. And I edited it a lot in order to, frankly, get through the emotional side of it so I could talk about it without bursting into tears. But it's one of those moments where I'm a firm believer that crisis helps bring balance. Nature does this all the time. Thunderstorms, earthquakes, you know, moments of crisis bring balance. And as I'm further and further away from the actual moments of the trauma, I'm capable of seeing more how they helped rebalance my life. And for that, I'm actually very grateful for them. I mean, I'm incredibly grateful I lived, because that was not always clear that was going to happen. But now that I know I'm alive, and now that I know I'm healthy, I can actually look back on it with some semblance of fondness in a way. Which sounds crazy as I'm saying it out loud.
Well, you know, going back to that moment, and I know it's hard to do, but when you're faced with mortality like that, where non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I've had family members die from that, and it's not something that, because of it's systemic cancer. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, remove a tumor and everything's going to be okay. It's not, right. You know. So being in that spot, facing mortality as you go through chemo and waves that it works and it doesn't work, and having to go into surgeries, how did you approach dying?
I approach dying in two ways. One is, I was actually told early in my diagnosis that from a doctor that he would rather have what I had than diabetes. I was very lucky that my particular version of cancer, of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, they knew how to fix it. That didn't necessarily mean that they always fixed it, but they did know how to fix it. And so I skipped over, so when it came to cancer, I skipped over that part. But when it came to chemo, which just destroyed me, and then especially the second surgery, where I literally almost died on the operating room table, I grew to appreciate that perhaps someone was trying to teach me something. I've never been particularly a person of faith, but living after those moments recalibrated that a bit for me. And I had to start believing that I was put on this planet in order to do something, because otherwise, why would I have had to go through this? And that might have been a mental game that I was playing with myself to just get me through the day. But it worked, because I decided that, you know, my purpose was to talk about this, and my purpose was to share a new way of thinking about transformation and about crisis that hopefully could help others approach their same transitions or similar transitions with some level of calm and some level of thoughtfulness.
There's a chapter on grace, and there's a chapter as well on living in the moment, and a lot of it associated around pain and having to just kind of be in the moment, being in the pain.
Yep.
But there is this Zen-like approach to recovery, where you have to live in that moment. And that's something you had to almost teach yourself.
Very much so. I was so committed to the power of my brain that paying attention to my body or the present moment was not something I was at all practiced at. Our brains are vitally important and brilliant pieces of anatomy, but they pull us out of the present moment, because brains live in the past and they live in the future. They literally can't live in the moment because they're talking at us all the time. And so learning how to put my brain where it belonged in order to feel what was going on in a present moment was a battle for me. But as as I learned, as you mentioned in those sections, mostly focused around pain, is that when I was in the present moment, the pain got lessened.
Yeah.
And I could actually be in it without feeling like I was just going to snap in half and die at that particular moment. And, I mean, and to be clear, these were incredibly ridiculous moments of such intense pain where I'd never felt anything like that before. And I've broken a lot of bones and I've been in a lot of accidents. And, but being present inside that gave me something to hold on to for the pain. And so as I got further along and I wasn't in quite so much physical pain, and perhaps there was some aspects of mental agony trying to figure out my life, but once I'm not being triggered by pain, I started seeing the value of being in the present moment for other situations, for pleasure, for life. And there's something so freeing about it, so beautifully freeing about it, that suddenly the rest of it didn't really matter.
The movie, you talk about transformation, and a lot of, we kind of mentioned right at the top, this idea of going back. And this is almost part of the treatment. It's prescribed. You know, once you get here, you'll be able to go back. You'll be able to go back to work. You'll be able to go back to your life. And that was something that, that was told to you, and it was continued to be like, you know, you got to go. You, once you get done with this, you'll be back. And it's interesting because you have a passage in the book about it, and I kind of talked about it at the intro. But you know, if you find it and you can read it, it's this idea that going back seems to be part of the process.
It is. So the section that he's talking about, I'll read it now. Because the future was unknown and the present was agonizing, I decided that the only way out was to go back to what I knew, job, body, health, or my former concept of it. This instinct echoed in the advice all around me. Go back to work. Go back to the gym. Go back to your life. Go back. Go back. Go back. No one ever grabbed me by the shoulders and said, go forward. So while I focused on the present of my marriage, I pressed my brain and my body backward into the only place that I knew, the past.
It's so startling when you read that because it makes so much sense. And I do want to get to life after the treatment. Let's start with your job. So it's this idea that you wanted to go back. There's a point in the book where you talk about, hey, you know, they covered my health insurance at this place. This is a big number after cancer treatment and everything that goes into that and the surgeries. I want to give back. At what point when you went back did you realize this is not what I want to be doing anymore?
Fairly quickly, honestly. I mean, the law firm was lovely. The people were extraordinarily supportive, but the minute that I walked back into it, and I was still, I still very much had chemo brain. This is a real thing. I was in a fog, and I was being asked to do the work of an associate at a large law firm. And suddenly I was like, "What? I can't do this." I mean, I literally could not physically do it. And luckily, I was in the bankruptcy section. Luckily, the economy was on an upswing, so we weren't that busy, but still, I mean, the work that I was being asked to do, I just couldn't do it. It took me longer. It was harder. I couldn't get my brain to wrangle. And I thought that if I just stayed in it long enough, if I sort of bullied my brain and my body back
force
into
your
what
way
they,
through it, right?
Yeah, just force my way through it, then eventually I would get back to the point where I could think that way and I could work those hours and I could do all of that stuff. I could lean in. I could do everything. And it just became clear the longer that I was at the firm that I couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. And it was so frustrating, but I couldn't.
Did you have to, I mean, was it frustrating because you're like, hey, I want to go back to who I was?
Yes.
I want to go back to this control freak. I want ambition to be part of my life. I know I can do this plus three other things. I want to be back to the way it was because that was who I... At what point do you say, you know what? I'm losing control and I need to practice the things that we just talked about, whether it's the grace or whether being in the moment. When did those things that happened to you in treatment, when did they register with you that your life was going to be different?
The minute that I almost died on the operating table 18 months after treatment ended, basically it was just a medical disaster of a day. And I had a hole in my heart and they were about to crack me open in order to fix my heart. And I was lying on the bed in the ICU and I said, how did I get here? How did this happen? And I'd forgotten meditate. I mean, when I was going through chemotherapy, I had a meditation practice. I had all of these brilliant insights, right? And then I just forgot about all of them while I was going back into my life. And there was just this moment while I was lying on the table in the hospital. And suddenly I said, okay, I've taken a wrong turn at some point, because otherwise, why would I be sitting here? And I don't mean to imply that when you land on a hospital table, it's your fault. But at some point, with the amount that I was going through, I just had to make a change.
Yeah.
And that brought back in all of these sort of Zen-like practices that I had cultivated. And suddenly I realized that I was now a round hole, trying to fit into a square hole, and it just didn't work.
You mentioned it in the book, and it's a little part of it about stress.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's not a direct implication that you got sick because of the stresses of the world that you had created. But there is some thought about the way that we process stress, and that the way that it manifests itself in people, especially after trauma. Mm-hmm. Is that part of it, that you recognize now that stress is something that is, I don't know what the right
toxic
word to be. Toxic is yeah, exactly the exact word. Yeah.
Well, it is. And I had an interesting conversation with a friend probably a couple of years ago. And, you know, any number of things can cause cancer, right? There's carcinogens all over the place. We breathe toxic air. We drink toxic water. We eat toxic food. We lead toxic lives of stress. Like, we're not doing a good job at managing our health at the moment as a society. And that can trigger cancer in any number of ways. But the true question there is, what is my body capable of handling that might be different from somebody else's body? And it turns out that my body, I'm not Dwayne Johnson. Like, I can't handle certain levels of stress. I can't handle certain types of food. The list goes on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And learning how to recognize that, not as a failure of my body's that I need to fix or ignore or somehow bully away, but as just a simple reality of who I am, that took a lot. That took a lot. And, recognizing just all of it. Because, I mean, this body that I'm living in is the only one I'm going to have for the rest of my life. You know, it's kind of a truism. And so if I don't start taking care of it...
It's been 7 years.
Yes.
And I'm interested, because we could do a whole other hour on your marriage and talk about Michael plays a big... You could make an argument this is a love story.
Yeah,
I think so. There's a lot in it about fixing things in your marriage that before were, happened because of the lifestyle you were living and how that was fixed or at least changed after treatment. It has been 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
How are you living differently? When you look back now and this book and everything about it, can you draw a line and say, I am living what my book is saying? I am different than I was when I was 32.
Well, I mean, my job and my life looks very different. That is true. I no longer work at the law firm. I've written this book. I'm seeing where this is taking me. I'm much less concerned about planning my life. I spend a lot of my time now trying to pay attention to the currents where life might take me and engaging with those. And I had a thought and it just left my head, but...
It's okay. No, it's... I mean...
My life looks exceptionally different. But at the same time, I don't want listeners to sit here and think, oh my goodness, she went all zen and now she's super weird about this. I mean, like, this is a daily practice for me, right? Like, not judging myself for the fact that I'm not at a law firm with the number of degrees that I have or somewhere else that is equally exalted
right,
is a daily practice for me to be comfortable with that and to forgive myself for it. And not to forgive myself for the fact that I'm not doing it anymore, but to forgive myself for the fact that I thought I could in the first place. It's a daily practice. Yeah. And so that's really where my life is different. I mean, it looks different from the outside just because I've changed my job. But the inside is really the true thing that has shifted.
Yeah. Lydia Slaby, the book is Weight, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. I can't thank you enough for coming in, sharing your story, and congrats on the book. It's a great read. And again, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I know that track. Little Girl K for you here on Extension 720. Yeah. Good conversation about transformation. That's a tough, I mean, if you're one type of personality and you have something like cancer happen and you have to go through the treatment and you have to switch personality from being, you know, if you're a control freak, right? You have to think about how you have to live your life differently. That's tough. That's on top of the treatment, the cancer, the trauma, all that kind of stuff. So you can understand how tough that is. It's just great. It's a great read. You should pick it up. Weight, It Gets Worse is the book. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to talk to Steve Dolinsky. The Hungry Hound is in studio to talk about his move into pop-up retail, or restaurateur. He's a restaurateur now, specifically. He's a curator. He's the Revival Food Hall down in the Loop is presenting Steve's pizza curations.
Is so it like Steve's homemade pizza?
It's not his pizza. He is curating.
Oh, nice.
So he is essentially bringing Chicago-style pizza to Revival. So I think it's in a couple of months, every couple of months, a different pizza place takes over and
That's
serves
awesome.
Up their kind of Chicago pizza, which is, yeah, what a great thing. And it's authentic and it's different. So it's a good call, and I like that idea. But we'll talk with Steve, who's here, come up at the 9 o'clock hour. And then we continue our Chicago Neighborhoods tour. We went last time to Inglewood, and now we're going to go to Jefferson Park and have a conversation at Weston's Coffee. Here's a real quick clip.
The city's problems are our problems, and I think that it's kind of gone back to I want to just care about my ward, and I want somebody advocating only for me and not necessarily getting distracted by the overall city.
Yeah, that's Maggie Barron. She hosted us at Weston's Cafe, Coffee and Tap up on Milwaukee Avenue. We're going to talk Jefferson Park politics. For the last 8 years or so, they've had a progressive alderman, someone at the top. John Arena was one of the leaders of the Progressive Caucus, and they've decided to go back, voted him out of office outright, no runoff. And for a former EMT and Jim Gardner, and the neighborhood is moving away from the progressive politics of the current past, if you will, and moving to a more... A past, if you will. So all that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour here on Extension 720. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chicago has always been a city of neighborhoods, almost like separate little towns. And now more than ever, the needs of these communities should be front and center. Why? Because it's election season. Both mayoral candidates are crisscrossing the city playing genre politics, but are they listening to the needs of the communities they're trying so hard to represent? We continue our tour of Chicago neighborhoods tonight. Last time we were in Inglewood, tonight, Jefferson Park. Jefferson Park is on the northwest side of Chicago, Lawrence and Milwaukee and the surrounding area. It's a tight-knit community of single-family homes handed down from generation to generation. It's also home to many cops and firefighters. The area, predominantly white, but that's changing as more Latino residents move north and west.
Politically, it's the 45th Ward, a ward that was run by powerful Alderman Patrick LaVar for years. He ran the Aviation Committee, that's airport contracts, and maybe most famous for being one of Edward Doliak's 29, the group that stood in defiant opposition of Chicago's first black mayor, Harold Washington. But more recently, the 45th Ward was represented by a progressive politician who was one of the original members of the City Council's Progressive Caucus. But just this year, Alderman Arena defeated outright by Jim Gardner, a former EMT with very little political experience. So what does it mean? Who better to talk politics with than my friend Maggie Barron? Maggie and I met 15 or so years ago as young bloggers. I like Maggie. She's feisty. She's homegrown. She's a super mom. She's also the chair of the local LSC, a cancer survivor, and for good measure, a Chicago Accent Challenge winner. She chose the place, Weston's Coffee and Tap, just across the street from the train station on Milwaukee. Weston's is a newer business to the area, but it's caught on as the place is packed daily with commuters and residents, both wanting the lavender latte and the prosciutto toast. A perfect place to talk Jeff Park.
Coming up this way, you just see there's a steady flow of people coming in this place.
Right.
But that hasn't always been the case in Jefferson Park, because I know the Gale Street Inn, which is right up the street, but I used to get off at this train station 15, 20 years ago, and I would love a Weston, but there was right. there wasn't. This neighborhood's changed.
Weston's has only been around for a year or so, and it was a big development where they really redeveloped this building, and there's residential on the upper floor, and then down here, Nick runs Weston's. There have been a lot of newer businesses in the last... I've lived here in this neighborhood. I mean, I'm a Chicago native, but I've only lived in Jeff Park for about 7 years. Mm-hmm. And I would say in that time, there have been a lot more businesses like Weston's opening up, like Fishman's, Weston's, Fanny's Cafe, further south in the ward on Montrose. So we have a lot more opportunity for places.
Why? Because it's been a long time for Jefferson Park. It's one of those northwest side neighborhoods that has that kind of keep it like it was vibe. But what is it about the last couple of years that we've seen more and more of these small businesses kind of come up?
I think that there is a hunger from residents. A lot of people moving into the neighborhood are younger families, moving into a single family home, probably, wanting to commute with the Blue Line. And so there's been a need, and there's also, there are plenty of still empty and vacant storefronts, and a lot of retail, the big retail is closing, like Sears closed, the big auto parts store closed, but it made an opportunity for smaller, more boutique businesses that can attract people to actually come in, but you can't order a lavender latte online.
Yeah.
It's
true.
You know,
have you tried?
Well, maybe I could call and ask for delivery, but I really think that's kind of where retail businesses are going anyways. It's more about service and food and creating a place for people to gather together as opposed to a place where people buy stuff because most people buy stuff online.
Right.
I would say there's been a huge investment in the community. I would also credit John Arena, the alderman.
The outgoing alderman.
Yeah. He really brought a lot of new businesses in that are like this, that are, attracting different people. The great thing about Weston's, it's not just a coffee shop that, closes at 3. They're open at night. They have alcohol on tap, and they're a great place, for people to stop on their way home.
Okay, so let's talk about Jefferson Park, and I want to talk about the election, too.
Okay.
We've known each other for a long time. You cover a lot of Chicago early on when you're blogging. You know the city well.
Yeah.
Is it safe to say that Jefferson Park is a microcosm of the city of Chicago? It's got a lot of different things in it, and it's got a lot of different styles. But when you think about Jefferson Park, can it be described as Chicago?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think that... It's technically Chicago, but even the residents, and especially the longtime residents, say, well, it has a suburban feel. It has a suburban enclave. And even when I was growing up, it was kind of, once you got west of Cicero, I grew up near the lake in, Edgewater. And so, it was kind of a foreign country for me to go west of Pulaski. And I think the people I've met who grew up around here, it's kind of the same, but east of Pulaski.
Right.
And And
it's isolated.
There's a very...
The expressway has a lot to do with that.
The expressway has a lot to do with it. And, you know, kind of cuts right through. And there's really no easy way to get east to west in the city. Right. So it really does kind of create some physical boundaries.
The Jefferson Park is one of those areas and one of those neighborhoods that if you are asked where you live, you almost say Jefferson Park before you say Chicago. That it's Jefferson Park is almost feels like a suburb because it's got that name. You wouldn't necessarily think this is in the Chicago boundary because of the way that the residents talk about it. You don't get that in every neighborhood.
No, you don't. And Jefferson Park, I think, isn't even as extreme as like Norwood Park and Edison Park, which is as you're going further and further close to the border or Edgebrook. But I think the Northwest Side in general has this kind of haven type of, you know, long-term residents who, you know, maybe it's multi-generations in the home and the house gets passed down. And it's one of the last really affordable neighborhoods in the city for people to hold on to their houses. I mean, my mother had to sell her house in West Edgewater because she couldn't keep up with the taxes. And I certainly wouldn't be able to afford a house on the block I grew up on. But out here in Jeff Park, it's still moderately affordable. And I think that's drawing a lot of new people,
right?
But with the same kind of core family values that, you know, they want to walk to school. That's why we moved here.
What do people in Jefferson Park care about? And I want to say, not only just want to throw it out because you're human beings like everybody else. But when you're thinking about it in the terms of the election and what's coming up in the runoff, what are the issues that are being talked about from the candidates that Jefferson Park cares about, that they want to dig in on?
Well, I think that, you know, our aldermanic election showed that there's kind of two Jefferson Parks right now. There is the traditional multi-generational Jefferson Park, the lot of first responders in the community, and also multi-generational first responders. And so they're concerned with their pensions. They're concerned also hyper-locally with making sure that the streets stay nice.
Right.
And, you know, that...
Someone fills the potholes.
That someone's filling the potholes and that they can call and they can get services from the city and that they're not being overlooked. It's a lot less about the city as a whole. There's a lot of talk about school overcrowding, which has been alleviated over the last few years. There's been an addition put on at Pressing School, a lot of improvements to the schools up here because of the advocacy of aldermen.
And more people are moving here, and that's why you have to...
Right. And, you know, it's one of those things where you want more people, but we also need to be able to accommodate them.
Right. You referenced the outgoing alderman, and there's two Jefferson Parks. John Arena, who's leaving, lost to Jim Gardner, who's a firefighter who ran against him. And John Arena was a big name in city council on the progressive caucus. He stood for a lot of progressive issues, won the first in the city council.
Yeah.
But Jefferson Park, maybe not as progressive as he is in the way that there has been a fight to almost reclaim and say that, you know what, that's all good and well that you want to do that downtown, but this is what we believe in here in this community. Do you see it that way?
I absolutely do. I feel like John Arena was really a representative for the whole city, and he serviced the ward very well. I mean, he advocated for, on a city level, to bring resources, but he also wanted to bring the city more into Jeff Park through things like affordable housing. And that, I think, you know, instantly is going to turn some people off. They want to keep their suburban like haven. I think a big reason why Jim Gardner was so successful was because he ran as, I grew up here, I share the same values as the people in the community, I care about you more than I care about the city as a whole. And I think that there are, you know, some old school people who feel that aldermen, it's almost like a little town. It's like you're the mayor of your little ward and you represent 50,000 people, and that's your turf. And so I think there's been a shift that, you know, John Arena represented a shift towards, hey, I'm representing this ward, but we're part, the city's problems are our problems too.
Right.
And I think that it's kind of gone back to, I want to just care about my ward, and I want somebody advocating only for me and not necessarily getting distracted by the overall city.
I read the newspapers. I pay attention to ward stuff. I find it to be extremely fascinating. It's a nasty type of politics up here in the 45th Ward, right? There have been some very close elections. There's been some fisticuffs. There's been people ripping signs out. I mean, they get real passionate about their politics up here.
They really do. And I think the advent of social media kind of coincided with a very long-term established alderman, Pat LaVar, leaving, John Arena replacing him. The advent of social media, where now people can go on and
yell at people.
And yell at people, essentially, that they've never met right. and probably never will meet, but, you know, they create these bizarre online relationships. And that has perpetuated some of the ugliness.
Do you think it's fair, you know, with the affordable housing fight that was here?
Yeah.
And over the 5150 and, mm-hmm. and all the things that are happening and what really played out in the election. Do you think it's fair that other wards and other neighborhoods in Chicago look at Jefferson Park and go, oh, man, that's racist up there? Or, you know what, they don't want poor people there. I mean, because it feels like those issues get boiled down, especially when they get synthesized and synthesized down to other wards. Is that an unfair characteristic over the fight for affordable housing in Jeff Park?
I think that it's not a good look. We'll put it that way. I think that overall, Jefferson Park, especially with what happened over the 5150 Northwest Highway, created some really, really strong opinions and had people demonstrating some really ugly behavior, mostly online, but some in person, that made the neighborhood look less attractive for people who would want to come in and revitalize the neighborhood. Right. And so it's a problem, but again, the insular kind of community that, you know, didn't want, they want to keep it like it is. They want to keep it like it was. Or better, that it's actually not like it is. They want to keep it like it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago or whenever, you know, they were growing up. And things have just changed, and I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
You are a political observer. You've always been someone who's, you know, has strong opinions. We got a pretty great mayoral race.
Oh yeah.
In the way the two candidates that came out of a runoff in Lightfoot and Preckwinkle. Where does Jefferson Park stand? Not necessarily you, Maggie,
right.
But where does this neighborhood stand? Because a lot of, like you said, a lot of first responders, but yep. There's also a strong progressive community here. I would assume that there's a tough choice to be made here.
Absolutely, and you can see that faction playing out with the runoff as well. Mm. The Firefighters Union endorsed Lori Lightfoot, huh? And Alderman Spezzato and Alderman Napolitano, who are pretty much on either side of this ward, were right there for the endorsement. This ward went really heavily for Daley and Joyce. And what I love about this runoff with Jefferson Park is that there's no clear-cut, like, oh, it's the white man versus the black woman. You know, you can't bring that into the mix.
Right.
It really is about, you know, what the core values are that you think. Now, what I'm seeing in the ward is that the same groups that are insular, and
yeah,
this is what happened, I think, with John Arena losing, is it wasn't about who won, it was about who lost. You know, the voters in the 45th Ward didn't really necessarily need to know what Jim Gardner or Marilyn Morales or Bob Bank was about. They just didn't want John Arena anymore. So it wasn't about who won, it was about who lost. And I think that the same type of sentiment is towards Tony Preckwinkle. I think voters, especially up here, the more conservative, who have been very critical of Tony Preckwinkle since she became president of the Cook County Board, they want her to lose.
Right.
I don't know if they necessarily...
They want the establishment to lose.
I don't know if they necessarily support Lori Lightfoot.
They just want
Tony Preckwinkle.
That weird
to
thing
lose.
That's happened in our society. It is. I mean, you saw that in the presidential elections.
Absolutely.
It's not about who we want to win. It's about who we want to lose.
It's all about, I like to say, it's like the epic takedown culture. You know, like, I'm going to burn them and they're going to lose and I'm going to feel so good when they lose. But what deal are you making with the winner? What do you really know about the person that you're supporting just to knock out somebody else? And I don't think that's a healthy way to look at how you vote, personally. I don't approach it that way. But a lot of people do.
Always great to see you. And it's always great to see you in Jeff Park. You know, we see each other in other places, but to actually be in Weston's Coffee and Tea on Milwaukee Avenue is great. Maggie, thanks so much for talking.
Thanks for having me.
Maggie Barron in Jefferson Park at Weston's Coffee and Tap right on Milwaukee. On Friday, we're going to continue our neighborhood tour. We're gonna go to Chatham on 83rd Street and go to Mathers and talk with Kathy Cheney. We have a clip of that. That's coming up on Friday.
Because Chatham has always been one of those close-knit, familial neighborhoods where everyone felt like a relative. You looked out for each other. It made you feel safe. So when you have so many people coming in and going out constantly, there's a sense of security that it's lost.
Issues of public safety and crime in Chatham. We'll talk with Kathy on Friday here on Extension 720. Much more to come, including Steve Dolinsky, who is in studio with my pie. We'll talk pizza and his new venture popping up over at Revival Food Hall. We'll do that coming up here on Extension 720, so stay with us.
I love the street cafe. I'm on a street team. I love Meryl Streep and the flick, One True Thing. I love traffic. I love the colors, yellow and green. I like talk radio. When they talk about things, let's talk about things.
Extension 720, where we talk about things and we talk about pizza. Speaking of neighborhoods, we just talked about our Chicago neighborhood tour. Steve Dolinsky, who is the Hungry Hound over on ABC and a longtime award-winning food reporter here in Chicago.
With you.
Yes, that's right. I don't want to brag about the amount of James Beards we have together. But you're on a quest to bring neighborhood Chicago pizza downtown. And we're going to talk about this coming up in the segment. But that really is what this is. The Revival Food Hall pop-up is now active and ready to rock. And Steve Dolinsky is here in the studio. Good to see you, buddy.
You too. I'm very excited about this project. It's been kind of a passion project for the last month or so.
It seems like a no-brainer.
It is, because people come to Chicago, they want pizza, they go downtown, and they spend all their time in the Loop or in River North or wherever their hotel is, and they can't find that many pizzas. It's bizarre. You can find a lot of deep dish downtown. You can't find, you know, Palermo's 95th from Oakland. You can't find Pat's from Lincoln Park. It's been around since 1950 doing tavern style. And that always bugged me. Like, why can't you find neighborhood joints downtown? Because it's too expensive.
You're absolutely right. And downtown as well, not to harp on the downtown establishments, but maybe that's why you have hour and a half, 2 hour waits for some of the places on Ohio Street or wherever.
Probably. Yeah, I just feel like, well, that's what Revival does. They bring a lot of these neighborhood places downtown to the Loop, and it's Monday through Friday only. So it is mostly locals and people going there, you know, on their lunch breaks and stuff, but there are a lot of businesses in the area, and I think it's important for those folks to get something that's really local and speaks to the neighborhoods in Chicago.
Well, we're going to talk pizza tours and what's happening at Revival Food Hall with Steve Dolinsky coming up here after Andrea's News here on Extension 720, so stay with us.
He's the new sensation in the nation, Pizza Boy USA. He's the flying saucer innovation, Pizza Boy USA. He's getting ready now. Listen to that crowd. He's a Pizza Boy USA.
He's also the author of Pizza City USA, 101 Reasons Why Chicago is America's Greatest Pizza Town. He does the Pizza City USA pizza tours throughout Chicago. He's also the Hungry Hound on ABC 7 here in Chicago, a longtime award-winning reporter. Good to see you, Steve.
Great to see you. Thanks for having me on this new show. Congratulations on the reboot.
Thanks, man.
And I want to have a band that follows me around like an I'm Gonna Get You Sucker with the Shaft theme.
With that song?
I want to have that song trail me down Michigan Avenue at the Pizza Boy. I would love that.
Yeah, a lot of people would buy the book.
They would buy the book. They'd take the tour. Who is that guy?
That's
he
what
smells like garlic and oregano. That would be great.
You have been known to have, and I want to get into the Revival Food Hall stuff, but you've been known to have a pretty eclectic palate. That's one thing I've always loved about your diversity in the food that you would cover, whether it's Asian cuisine or some sort of hybrid or downtown restaurants. But you have landed on pizza, yeah. And it is now you're making T-shirts. You got songs. You got books. You got tours. Why? Why pizza over all the other food that you've tasted in the world?
Kind of by accident, actually. If I would have thought it would have been something that I'm really super duper passionate about, it might have been Korean food, and I was super jealous. The Tribune did a whole thing on New Koreatown this week. But pizza came up about 2-3 years ago because I'd read a listicle online saying these are the 7 hottest pizza places, and I thought it was kind of, you know, bunk because I didn't think that that person had done the research. And I thought, well, how difficult is it to go actually eat the pizza places and find out is there kind of a definitive order and what's the categories and rankings? And so I just took it upon myself to do it. And it took me about, the first wave was 76 places. Yeah. It took me about 3.5 months. I did 3 in 4 days. And then I got this book deal with Northwestern University Press. And then I did another 109. And so I kind of just, sort of like a dog that bit into something and I just couldn't let it go.
It's obsessive.
It was a little obsessive because people would, this is the other thing about social media. People chime in. They're like, hey, if you don't go to Pudgy's in Hegwish, this list is worthless. Hey, you better go to Phil's in Oaklawn. I'm telling you, Mr. Dolinsky. And don't forget about Barnaby's in Northbrook.
Did they freak out when you actually show up?
Well, yeah, because then I would post something about it from this place. So, yeah, I went to this place. There are a lot of sacred cows in Chicago, and I talk about this in the book. I talk about the Pig syndrome, pizza I grew up eating syndrome. Like my friends from Homewood and Flossmoor, they swear by Aurelio's is the best pizza in the world. You know, and I get that because you grew up with that pizza and that's your thing.
Right.
And so my whole approach was, hey, I grew up in Minnesota. I've lived in Chicago for 25 years. I don't have that bias about a Little League game or a sleepover or something that affected me as a child here. And so I come in with fresh eyes and everybody got a fair shake. There were nobody got a pass.
You are on the program because we want to talk about Revival Food Hall, but I think it fits into the theme tonight. We're talking about transformations and for you to move from what you've done as a reporter for years, telling everybody's story, to telling the story of pizza, to curating now. I mean, you're making a transition and a transformation to where you are finding a way to continually develop your career.
Because the book is so much about, you know, telling people kind of where to go, what I liked and what's interesting, and that there's more to Chicago than deep and stuffed. And of course, my thesis is that we're a tavern style, thin and crispy square cut town. And so I kind of curate this, if you will, through the book, like, hey, you should try this. You should try this. A lot of people haven't heard a lot of these places like My Pie, for example. And then the next step is someone asks me, hey, could you curate this pop-up series at this food hall in the Loop with very high visibility? You know, who would you bring in here? And so, yeah, I feel like they're entrusting me with, you know, something very sacred in Chicago when you talk about pizza.
Yeah.
You know, and who would you deem sort of noteworthy and locally grown and homegrown? You know, that's a big responsibility.
There is something really interesting about this concept in the way that Revival Food Hall is just one of several food halls that have popped up downtown Chicago. You're starting to see this trend around the country.
A ton of them, yeah.
This idea that it's essentially the food court. They've supersized the food court. A lot of small businesses and very elite food companies are coming in and serving their wares. But this idea of you coming in and saying, I'm going to pop up every 2 months, it's going to be a different pizza, I'm going to bring you my taste, my thoughts to this, that's something different. I mean, that's something that I feel at a certain point, we might see more of that. Chef's choices, restaurateurs' choices, things like that, where there are different ways to serve the clientele downtown than just a brick-and-mortar space.
Oh, yeah, because, listen, if you have the general manager of a food hall saying, I think this is good, versus the guy who's been covering pizza for quite a bit in Chicago saying, I think this is pretty good, I think that probably carries some weight, probably. And the good thing for us is we get visibility for the tours and the book, and there's Pizza City USA on this kiosk for the whole year. So it's good in that respect, too. But I remember, you know, Anthony Bourdain years ago, he was going to curate something on the west side of the city, and it got a lot of attention because, hey, here's somebody who's going to bring in these small mom and pops that they wouldn't come otherwise. I think that's the other thing. So when I reached out to like Pat's, you know, they trust me. There's a level of trust there because we've been doing tours with those guys and they know what we're about. And I said, look, I'm not going to put you in a situation where you're going to flop. And there's a lot of testing back and forth. We went to the check out the ovens quite a bit on Sundays just to make sure they worked with their style of pizza.
Well, that's the thing. The you're going into a space that was already a pizza place, right? It was the Union.
Yes, it was Union Squared. But again, it's a specific, it's a Blodgett, it's a stone deck. It gets to 650. You can't do Neapolitan pizzas in there. So I couldn't get Spaccanopoli or Forno Rosso because those are wood-burning ovens. You can't use a place that needs to have 900 degrees, 800 degrees because it only gets to 650. Pat's issue was there's a steel deck at their oven in Lincoln Park, and they're not used to a stone deck. And stone is actually porous, and it pulls more moisture from the bottom of the dough. Mm. And they already have a very dry dough at Pat's, so you don't need to have that situation. So it was a lot of testing with temperature and placement in the oven. And, you know, I want to make sure these guys showing their best, you know, their best foot forward.
And the idea of bringing a neighborhood place to downtown Chicago to essentially feed Chicagoans who may not be going out there. Well, who did you pick? Let's talk about this because it's a year long thing.
It's a year long. So every 3 months. So My Pie just started on Monday. Now they've been around since 71. They are only 5 months younger than Lou Malnati's, which you can believe. There are 52 Lou's, I think, and there's one My Pie. Yeah. And so I've loved them since day one.
They're a staple in Bucktown, and they're in that, right there in that, where that 7-Eleven is at,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's like a David. Korean nail place.
But that's what I mean. You would never find kind of unassuming.
Very unassuming, very hidden. And so if you don't know the place in Bucktown, you're never going to get it. And we take people there on the tour sometimes, and you know, they love it. They're like, I never knew this was here. They've been around since 71. So they're the first deep dish we're going to do, and they're now, Monday through Friday. The halls are from like 10:30 in the morning until 7 at night. The cool thing about they're doing, so you think deep dish, how am I going to eat a deep dish? They do personal pan pizzas all day long, like 7 or 8 different flavors. After 4 p.m., you can get a big, large pizza like the one I brought you here tonight, which is just gorgeous. In 3 months, it switches over middle of June to Pat's Pizza. So they've been around since 1950. Classic tavern style, thin and crispy, square cut. They're from North Lincoln Avenue. They're going to be there for 3 months in this summer. And then in September is Dante's, which is a couple locations in the city, mostly Logan Square and Avondale. They do a New York style slice. Mm. And a lot of Chicagoans think, oh, we don't have that kind of style here. We do. Dante's is one of the best, I think. And then the last one is Palermo's 95th from Oak Lawn. Just a classic Chicago thin crust joint, a little sweeter sauce. So they like a little sugar on the south side. So that's going to be the hallmark there from December probably through March of next year. So full year of programming every 3 months. And we're going to do third Thursday tours. So the third Thursday of the month, we're going to offer a pizza tour that starts at Revival on Thursdays at 6 o'clock.
Do you, if an oven goes out or a light bulb burns out, are you on the hook? You got to go and fix that?
Nope. Nope. My job, I am not the owner. I am not the proprietor. I'm the curator.
You're the curator.
I'm the curator.
It's a good gig.
And we get some exposure for our brand. And, you know, pizzacityusa.com is great. And people should come and take the tour, too.
All right. Well, we'll come back more with Steve Dolinsky here on Extension 720. We'll talk more about pizza and other things about Chicago food before we wrap up the hour at 10 o'clock. Extension 720, stay with us.
I don't want to be no personal pizza. I just want to live my life. I don't want to eat no personal pizza. Baby, give me just one slice.
In studio with us, Steve Dolinsky and a huge My Pie pizza.
It's
huge. That thing is huge. Who can eat that?
This is like the 14-incher. So you can get these after 4 p.m. from Revival. You can get them catered too. Revivalfoodhall.com.
Oh, really?
.com.
And Revival is down on Adams. It's the one by the old post office.
It's the old CPS headquarters.
Oh, yeah, right.
125 South Clark Street. Accessible by the Monroe stop on the Blue Line, I believe.
Do the protesters sometimes forget that that's not the CPS headquarters anymore? Anytime you ever saw CPS headquarters, it's because protesters were.
I've never seen anybody outside saying we want a contract, but it's really, there's a lot of people in there for lunch. A lot of people for lunch. They do a few thousand people run through there. I mean, there are so many offices down in the loop, and then of course people stick around, and like the companies will buy them dinner, and they have events, I think, in the building in the summertime outside. So there's a lot of activity there. And it's nice for these pizzerias because, you know, like in these neighborhoods, they're not doing a ton of business on a Monday or Tuesday afternoon.
Right.
And so they're coming downtown now. And I just saw Rich Aronson from My Pie downstairs, brought the pizza over. And he looked a little, you know, ashen. He looked a little tired because he's been on his feet all day. And he's not used to this in Bucktown. It's a little quieter. So it's cool. And he's like, I'm glad there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It's 3 months. And, you know, you work hard for 3 months and then you move on.
Revival is one of the, I think it's one of the forefathers of the food hall resurgence of the last couple of years, but there are newer food halls now. The lunch options in downtown Chicago have grown immeasurable in the last 5 years.
Yeah, there's one right off of, it's like 55 Monroe. There's a Well Street Market, which is really good. There's at least a dozen places in there. I mean, Revival tries to do neighborhood places. There's Astor Hall up on North Michigan Avenue. That's Brendan Sotikoff's Hog Salt Group in Bloomingdale's, up in the ninth floor, which is not so, you know, easy to get to from the street. But, you know, is there going to be saturation? I think so. We're kind of headed that way because I know Urban Space is coming to town from London. They're going to do two food halls. One is going to be in Willis Tower, where they're spending a bunch of money redoing the whole first two floors of Willis. There's going to be a big food hall in there. So, but I, you know, listen, if you work in that area and you don't bring your lunch to work,
why not do that?
Why not? Because it's like you don't want to leave the building. You've got lots of options. The cool thing, like at Revival, does a permanent pop-up every couple of months. There's a new space in there, and so besides the pizza, and so it gives you an option, I think. And you know, people get tired of eating the same thing all the time. So I kind of like the fact that you have all these options, and they are very high quality operators. There's the Sbarro's, I think, are those days are over.
You know, it is interesting because the James Beard Awards will be coming up here. It's a to-do here in Chicago for the food industry in the beginning of May, end of April. You know, but there was an article that came out in the last year in Chicago Magazine that said maybe Chicago's time as a foodie capital is past.
Yeah.
And I thought about you because I know that you have lived through trying to be a booster for Chicago, whether it be in New York or L.A. or wherever it might be, saying this is the town for it to actually happen, and it happened. Is there some truth to the article that Chicago is that title might be moving on?
Yeah, there was some truth to it. It hit a lot of people very hard, I think, in the restaurant industry. You know, like I said, I've been raising the flag for 20-some years. You know, I took issue with some of the things he talked about. You know, we don't cover the immigrant restaurants, immigrant communities enough. He was comparing it to suburban Atlanta. There's some really great eating out there, and Houston even, too. And we have that in Chicago, but it's not covered enough. It is covered more now, I think. You know, people at the Tribune are doing it. Mike Gebert at Food Deter does a great job with it. But probably not enough. You know, a lot of the media tends to focus on what's downtown and what's easy to cover and sort of and doesn't do that. And, you know, some of the things they said, like, we are kind of dominated by restaurant groups between Let Us Entertain You and Hog Salt and the Boca Group. There are, you know, those five restaurant groups control, and One-Off Hospitality control about 25 or 30, way more than that, actually, about 50 restaurants with lettuce. So that was one of the complaints. You know, why can't you get live charcoal in Korean barbecues? Why can't you have more rice flour in the dough and for the banh mi sandwiches in Vietnamese restaurants? So, I mean, I agree with some of that, but I think that,
Is there an expectation from Chicago diners because there was such an explosion here? And there were so many great restaurants that came on so fast, and some of them that are world renowned. Alinea is one that comes to mind. That they're suffering from higher expectations. That they're now everybody wants an experience. They go to a restaurant and they're going to spend the kind of money that these restaurants are asking for. They want their mind to be blown. And if you don't do that, do they come back? Do they walk away going, it's not what I thought it was?
Well, no, I think people come to Chicago to eat for sure, because we are always in some kind of an annual roundup of some magazine or in-flight thing or online roundup. So people come here, they know they're going to eat. And there are places to meet that demand. Besides Alinea, you can go to Oriole or Smith or Elsk, or, you know, there's lots of places to find, even Blackbird, which is 20 years old, still killing it. So there are fantastic places to eat here. But, you know, at the end of the day, I am boots on the ground, you know, in the most granular way, in terms of, like, I'll go to a Niles strip mall and have Korean food. And today I was on the west side. I mean, literally the west side, eating fried chicken. But I think at the end of the day, people, as much as we are sophisticated, people in Chicago love barbecue and fried chicken and burgers and tacos. I see a lot of that coverage, you know, five new hot taco places and six places to get brunch. I mean, I just,
As somebody who has traveled the world reporting on food, what do you think Chicago needs to get better at?
I think we need, We need to have chefs that can really push the envelope beyond the beets and goat cheese and trout and sort of the familiar. And I think that a lot of people worry that if they do something too out of the box, it's not going to sell. And when you go to places like in Australia where they really understand breakfast, the breakfasts I've had in Sydney and Melbourne are just mind-blowing. Better than anything in New York, for sure. Just the treatment they have for the ingredients, where they source the ingredients from, what they put on the plate. It's not just eggs and bacon and pancakes for breakfast. It's really creative cooking. And I just feel like, you know, New York to some extent too, we don't have that in Chicago a lot of times. I think they tend to play it a little bit safer unless you're well capitalized, you come from a restaurant group and you have the money and the ability to do that. You know, Rick Bayless can afford to put in a 24-foot hearth at Lena Brava and just do wood-fired cooking and no gas because he's got a reputation and people come for his cooking. You know, not everybody can do that. And I wish we had more of that, though. I wish there was more experimentation. And they do a lot with small spaces in New York City that we just don't do here as well.
You know, the James Beard Awards coming through. Do you have any thoughts on who we might see when the nominations come out for restaurant opportunity, or, you know, for chefs and for restaurants and things like that? Is there anything that's on your radar that's like, oh, this is their year?
Could be. Well, I didn't even see the semifinalists. I was trying to think who was on there. But, you know, the guys from Boca are always up for a restaurant tour. I think this could be their year for sure. Chicago is always good for one or two awards. You know, we got smoked last year. I think we got, like, just one award. It was Fat Rice was Best Chef Great Lakes Region. We're usually good for that one. Meg Gallus from the Boca Group, probably up for Pastry Chef, has a very good chance. I would love to see Cellar Door Provisions get something. Julia Kramer wrote a great piece in Bon App this month about them. She's originally from Chicago, and she lives in New York now, and she just had this beautiful love letter to Cellar Door Provisions. Bitty Adia Zeta Goza on the Southwest Side was nominated for Service, which was kind of interesting. So I'd like to see the little neighborhood joints get a shout out. Not that, you know, the places in River North don't deserve it, but I'd like to see the not so well capitalized places get some press love.
Well, you can go get some of the neighborhood pizzas down at Revival Food Hall. You can get a Revival. Is it revivalfoodhall.com?
Revivalfoodhall.com. Yeah, you can get catering from there, I guess. But yeah, come and see us down in the loop every day, Monday through Friday only. And like I say, my pie's there now for the next three months. The deep dish is phenomenal. If you haven't had their deep dish, you've got to try it. It's very, very good.
And it is a favorite among the staff here, the nighttime staff that's already gone through.
I see that. They're chowing on it. And go to pizzacityusa.com and check out a tour.
There you go. Steve Dolinsky, great to see you. Thanks for being here, bud.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me.
All right, that's going to do it tonight for Extension 720. We're back on Friday nights. Cory Doctorow is going to be in studio. He's at Comic-Con. The longtime Boing Boing writer and author will be on. He's got a new book called Radicalized. Looking forward to talking to him. Always love when Cory Doctorow is in Chicago, so that's coming up. Patty Vasquez coming up next. Hi, Patty.
Hello. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. What do you got going on tonight?
We have Dan Protest, who's a writer and producer at WTTW. He's got a show called Urban Nature, available digitally now.
I love Dan.
So it's a great...
He's a good dude.
Great conversation with him coming up, and a couple comedians, Rocky Laporte, and a production of Pinocchio that I want to tell everybody about.
Oh.
And Dr. Dingman, so get your iTunes psychic reading coming up after midnight.
That's a show.
That's a show. You had one as well. It was a great conversation tonight.
Thank you. Well, have a great show. Yeah.
Have a good night, you and Pete. Thank you.